This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Oh, hello, buds. It's your boy, Michael Cruz Kane, back with another episode of A Good Cry and Hot Dog. Do we have a good one today? But first, let me start, as I always do, by thanking the people who are messaging me, DMing me, etc. That email again is agoodcry@theradiopoint.com. I love hearing from you, and I am in the process of getting back to everyone. Have I gotten to everyone yet? No, I haven't. Will I? Yes, I swear it on all that is holy, even though I am not religious. Okay, grief thoughts. I am reading Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's book, Notes on Grief. She is an amazing writer. She wrote We Should All Be Feminists. She wrote Americana. And now she's written a book about her father who died in 2020. And the book is incredible. I'm going to read you just a little bit of it. This excerpt is from chapter 10, where she talks about the things people said to her after her father died to console her and how that made her reflect on the things she used to say to people who had recently lost someone. I wince now at the words I said in the past to grieving friends. Find peace in your memories, I used to say. To have love snatched from you, especially unexpectedly, and then to be told to turn to memories. Rather than succor, my memories bring eloquent stabs of pain that say, this is what you will never again have. I hope that it is a question of time, that it is just too soon, too terribly soon, to expect memories to serve only as salve. Wow. I mean, obviously I feel for her. I'm sorry for her loss, but this is beautiful writing and I would imagine so relatable to so many of you who've gone through this. And what I would say to her if I could speak to her is, it probably just is too soon. And maybe it's not. Maybe you'll feel this level of pain for a long time, forever. But for me and for many people I've spoken to, what feels like totally insurmountable and at the same time bottomless, right? So high and so deep. There is actually a gradual diminishment of pain, not of memory or even of grief specifically, but of anguish. That gradually goes away, which is one of the things I talk about with today's guest, Adam Caton Holland. Wow, what a segue. I'm pausing to admire my own segue. What a great job I did. Five stars, five-star review for me. Adam lost his sister many years ago, and he has gone on to write a book about it. He's a stand-up. I know he's worked on a show about it and has been someone who's been very public in the grief community about loss for a long time. We talk about a lot of stuff, including ways in which his sister might still be here among us. There's a lot of discussion of red tail hawks. We talk about how long it takes for that pain you feel immediately to dissipate or to transform itself into other feelings. And we also talk about what it's like to be someone in your community or in the world who is known as a grief boy, like a grief person, and the ways in which that can be a weight and the ways in which it can also be a privilege. I think of it still at this point anyway as an honor, and I'm humbled by the messages I receive and the trust that you people listening put in me to hear what I have to say in these conversations that I have, including this one that I love very much. This is Adam Caton Holland on A Good Cry. I hope it helps. Adam, thanks for joining me on A Good Cry. How are you? First of all, how are you doing today? How is your day? Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm doing all right. Our little seven-month-old got me up at 4:30.
Ooh!
So I've been up for a while, but I'm feeling good.
Is that how many kids do you have? You said the seven-month-old.
That's number two. So I have a three-year-old and a seven-month-old. And the seven-month-old's an early riser. We see a lot of sunrises around here.
Beautiful. And that's a gift. That is a gift.
We attack the day at my household.
How's three-year-old feeling about seven-month-old? Into it or?
Into it, you know, appropriately so. He's a good older brother. He's into it, but he definitely, you know, we started him doing like half-day preschool stuff, and he lives to go to that now. He just wants to get out and go.
Get me out of here.
Yeah, go have friends and be his own little dude.
Yeah, right on. Okay, so now we're doing, now the podcast will happen. It's happening now.
Oh, wow.
So our opening question is, Adam, what is your relationship with grief?
My relationship with grief, huh?
Yeah.
I would say constant.
Yeah?
Yeah. I have a constant relationship with grief. You know, I lost my little sister. Let's just get right into it. Mm-hmm. To suicide 9 years ago. And so that is sort of a defining moment in my life, for better or worse. And I just recently lost a very dear friend, and, you know, we've all lost people over our lives. But I feel like I've gotten more than most. At least that's how people tend to look at me.
Yeah. I think sibling is unusual at our age. Parents is relatively, everyone sort of expects that you have a friend or two in the group who's lost a parent, but I think sibling is, it's still unnatural.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's not like you want to have a pissing match when it comes to these things, but generally I got a pretty big one in my life. So yeah, that's not a one that you, and I think any sort of severe grief, you never are like, and now I'm recovered.
Right.
But I think with the loss of a sibling, it's definitely always there. You know, the best metaphor is just like you kind of lost a limb and you always just feel that phantom limb still.
Yeah, you feel it. You feel it moving even if other people don't see it. You're like, no, it's there. It's just different now.
Totally. So yeah, that's how I would describe my relationship to grief.
And has it, you described it as constant. Is it less acute, or is like the acuity just more spread out, or is it as acute as it ever was?
No, that's such a good question. It's way less acute. It's way less acute because those first years, months are so acute that you feel like you can't go on. So for it to remain that severe would just be a death sentence for me. Way less acute. But what's weird is it's now kind of, controllable for me, and I can choose sort of when I tap into it. Like, all right, I'd like to go remember my sister, be sad. We got her this bench in the park right by where I live, right next to the lake, and it's a memorial bench, and I'll go over there when I want to just tap in, you know?
Yeah. Do you live where you grew up?
I do. I live in Denver, Colorado, right next to the biggest park in the city, City Park, and my parents live across the park. My older sister lives a block away. It's a very close-knit unit over here.
Oh, wow. That's great. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good.
Sorry, I'm saying that's great for me. I don't want to speak for you, but to me that sounds cool.
It's cool, but it's kind of just like your parents don't appreciate that you live right next to them. Like, hey, by the way, I need help moving this box of shit. And you're like, but why don't you act like I live in New York and are grateful that I'm there at Christmas? but it's good to have that casual relationship with your parents.
Yeah, I think after I said it, I was like, would I want to live like right next to my parents? I love them. I love them very much. But we're like an hour and a half from them, and that feels like optimal distance. It's like if we ever need each other, we can get there.
Sure.
But you can't just be like, I'm popping by.
Yeah. There's a lot of, my dad, we call him Poppy. And my older sister coined the term, or the grandkids call him Poppy.
Yeah.
And the Poppy Pop-In. And we all live in fear of the Poppy Pop-In because he's like any old man. He's like, I'm up at 5. Let's do it. And you're just like, all right, daddy. He pops in at 6:30, ready to chat your ear off. You're like, okay, all right, Poppy Pop-In. We're doing it.
Yeah. My dad also, I mean, my dad would come every day because he's like just the most like loving person that ever existed. But he's saving up stories and he's going to tell you start to finish regardless of your input.
Yeah, so is my dad. My dad's very loving, wants to get on the phone, wants to chat every day. It's sweet. Most people are like, man, I want your dad. And you're like, buyer beware. It's you really got to be all hands on deck. He needs a lot from you.
I make fun of the storytelling, but I have that's genetic where like I'll tell a story and I'll start telling my kids and they will say to me, Dad, you've already told us this story. And I will say, I think I have to keep telling it. I don't know how to stop in the middle of this.
Sure.
Anyway, I derailed us completely. You live where you grew up close to your parents and your older sister.
Yeah, exactly.
And you have a bench in the park right by you. Did you guys had that bench put in? What's that like?
You know, I did. I just kind of felt like we never buried my little sister. My parents have her ashes in their house, and it's just we're not really a religious family or anything. We had an informal funeral in my older sister's backyard. And I just kind of felt like I needed something, somewhere to go. And my little sister Lydia and I would go to that park all the time. I like bird watching. She did too. We were just bird nerds. And I remember going there a lot. There's an island called Bird Island right there. So I looked it up. And then, you see those memorial benches. It's pretty easy to do. And it's a couple $1,000 and there you go. You get a plaque and a bench in the park. And
there's no hullabaloo. You're just like, I want the bench and boom, it's there.
Pretty much. I mean, you just got to go through some bureaucratic, a couple months of paperwork and crap. And they're like, yeah. And it was crazy. A nice city official came out. I think they have a good bedside manner because they have to deal with people who are probably sad about this.
Right.
And she just walked me around the lake and she's like, where would you like it? And I said, here. And she's like, how about 100 feet further from the previous bench? I said, yeah, great. Let's do it. So it worked out pretty nice.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah, I guess I never thought about, when my son died, we had a tree planted in the park that was right by our house. And I don't remember what the process was, except that the lady seemed so sad about our story that I feel like we could have gotten her to plant like anything. We could have been like, we want a pool in the park. And she would have been like, great, we'll do it.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure at that time you didn't need her sadness either. You're just like, do we just need to get the tree done?
Yeah, just give us the tree, lady.
Yeah.
So you said that you feel like some level of control over the grief now where it's like, okay, talk more about that.
I was going to say, I do feel a level of control over it, and it comes from having done a ton of therapy. However, there are moments when it still hits you unexpectedly, and those are so sharp and so acute. They're just, it's like somebody just punched you in the gut and you're over it, you know?
Yes.
So I don't have full control, and I don't think I ever will, but so those ones that surprise you, and now it's almost 10 years in July since we lost my sister, but I don't like them, but I'm almost glad to be like, okay, you're not a robot. You just tapped into the very real feelings again. Good. It should still hurt this much.
Right. You're still a human being.
Right.
And it is like that sense of tapping in does feel very real to me of like there is this eternal flow of death through which every human being will pass. And that every once in a while, those of us who are still alive, like touch it. You know what I mean? You like dip your finger in it and look at it. I don't know. Does that?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, and also for me, and I don't know how it is for you, but like I wrote a book about this and I do comedy and I'm doing a one man show about this. And like, that's kind of how I deal with stuff. But that also makes it very much me controlling the narrative. Here's my talking points that I'm willing to present to people about it. Here's the story as I've culled it and put it out for consumption. So I have it. It's almost like you're a politician. You have your stump speech about your grief experience.
Yes.
And here are the talking points I hit. And so when you deviate from those kind of, then it gets way realer, you know?
Yeah. I empathize with that completely. I have this podcast on which I pretty much say the same thing episode after episode.
Sure.
And then there's also, I also have worked on a show about it and, I've tweeted about it or whatever. And there's definitely like points where you're like, and I'm back into the shtick of it.
Right.
What is what's your may I ask, what is your shtick? What are the talking points? What are the
things?
Well,
I mean, the shtick, the book.
I'm being funny about it, but
the book is a book length, you know, and the one man show is an hour, so there's a lot of them. But I mean, I think it comes down to my talking points tend to be, I mean, I should say, just for your listeners' knowledge, like, the story's deeper than that. I found my little sister.
Oh, geez.
I was pretty suffering from PTSD to a bad degree, and I went through this extensive therapy called EMDR therapy, which I imagine you've dabbled with or heard of doing the work you do.
Yeah, but can you talk about that just a little bit so that people...
Sure. It's one of my talking points.
Great. We're in chapter 4 or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Read along with me, Michael. No, EMDR is for people who have suffered from PTSD, basically, any sort of trauma. And it's honestly, you hold like two pulsers in your hand and they sort of vibrate back and forth, like tick-tock, tick-tock. You close your eyes and you relive the experience with a professional. You go through the traumatic memory again and again and again. And it's kind of tricking your brain into thinking you're asleep. Your eyes are sort of going back and forth instinctively, simulating REM, which is what you do when you're in deep sleep. And so it's you kind of sleepwalking through it with a therapist who knows what they're doing. And you go through the trauma and like the metaphor, you know, therapists love metaphors for brains. That's like their bread and butter. They can't get enough of that shit. So the metaphor my therapist used was that the memory of finding my little sister had become an errant file in a filing cabinet. And so this therapy sort of files it away in an orderly fashion. It's like, there if I want it, but it's not going to keep popping up in nightmares or flashbacks, or it's filing the memory away. And it like, it so worked for me.
Oh, that's amazing.
Over the course of maybe like 10, 12, I don't even know. It was intense sessions. It worked. And you have to think of a happy place in your head to retreat to when this therapy gets way too much to deal with, which it does every time. But yeah, it's the memory. I was able to control it. I was having nightmares. I was in flashbacks. Those dissipated and went away. It was really effective for me. And I'm a big champion of it, but I've talked to people who have had terrible time with it. So I always am just like, be careful. And if you don't like your practitioner, it's like anything. There's good ones and bad ones. Maybe try it again. I think I lucked out and found like an ace therapist expert in this field, and she helped me a ton.
That's really great. I mean, I think that's true of any coping mechanism, right? That it's like, this works for me, but it may make your situation a lot worse.
Right. I mean, so, just in describing it, it's like, oh, by the way, that trauma, someone wants to go over it 40 times with you in detail. Hope they're good. Bye. Like,
bye. Good luck.
Yeah. So buyer beware. It's intense as hell, but it really did the trick for me.
That's amazing. Whatever works is the right thing, I think.
Exactly. And that's another like talking point that I've hit on. And I think people sort of, I've unfortunately become a expert in this sort of stuff, but like grief and mourning and trauma. The other talking point I always do is like, however you're doing it is right. That however you're choosing to do it is correct. Because I feel like there is a lot, especially in a family unit like I had, that we're all devastated by this. It wasn't like a private trauma. There was a lot of sadness all around it in every direction. You sort of will get to a point of healing, or you made a breakthrough, or you reached this conclusion, and you want everyone to come along with you, and you kind of don't want them to be sad at this moment, and they're on their own grief journey.
Yeah.
So I guess realizing that however they're doing it's right, however you're doing it's right, don't have expectations for other people or yourself even. Just plod along, because this is the process.
Did you feel like you had to, just the way you described that, there must have been a lot of navigating different people's relationship to the grief of losing your sister? Because for your parents, and you said you have another sister, right? An older sister?
Yeah, older sister, so, and I'm in the middle, and we lost Lydia, who's the youngest.
So for all of those people, it's an unnatural loss too, right?
Big time, big time.
So what did it feel like These are all sad questions, by the way. If you're like, I don't want to talk about this shit, we can pause.
Well, I know. I mean, this is my story, so I'm happy to talk about it. But yeah, if you ever want to spin off into tell me a dick joke, I'll do the dance.
talk about the Rockies for a minute.
Oh God, can't do it.
That I won't do. That's where I draw the line.
I have a line.
The navigating, dealing with this at the same time that your parents and your sister are dealing with it, and how, I don't know. I think for me, a lot of the grief of losing my son was trying to perform a version of okay for whoever. Just so like, you know, somebody else is here. They're super sad about it. Let me be okay so you can be okay for a minute. Or like trying to be a certain version of myself for my wife, who's not asking me to do that, but that's just the role that I fall into.
Yeah.
I wonder what that's like for you. I mean, like, you know, there's sort of the family hierarchy of like oldest, middle, youngest. People tend to fall into roles in that way. And I don't know. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, I think it was tricky in that initially I wanted to talk about it a lot. And my sister didn't want to talk about it at all. My mom didn't want to talk about it at all. I found out my dad and I were simpatico that way. You know, we wanted to talk about it. But then there were things to be done, settling of estate and things like that. And that got so real because it's just like bureaucratic and paperwork. And you're like, oh my God, this is so final. It's not abstract. I'm looking at death certificates. I couldn't deal with that. And my dad, who's a lawyer and ever competent, normally would deal with that. But he gave it to my older sister, who's like, yes, just give me busy work to like, so I don't have to tap in emotionally.
That made her feel good to be able to like have something to occupy her.
And my mom started a foundation in Lydia's name. And so it's like our grieving was like my dad and I were just like howling at the moon. And my sister and my mom were kind of like, we want to just deal with it through distracting ourselves through the busy work of it. We'll deal with it emotionally later. Or perhaps that's part of our emotional journey. But you just have to, I can see that in hindsight. During it all, it was a cluster. I don't know if you can swear on this podcast.
Yeah. You can say whatever. You can say whatever you want.
Yeah. It was a clusterfuck. So it was just like, you know, I remember we took a family vacation with my aunt and uncle and cousins to Maine because you do these sort of like trauma journeys to be like, let's just get away and not deal with it. But it's there, of course. It's like
right.
It's like the big chill. You know, it's like that sort of weekend.
Yeah.
And I remember my sister and I got good and drunk and I was like, here it is. Like, this is where we go out in the main night and have our talk about Lydia. And like, I just started to talk to her about it and it was so awkward and enforced. And you know, you expect these movie moments and it's not that clean. It was just like, it didn't work at all. And now we've had other talks about it, but it was just this stilted, awkward conversation. And we're like, okay, well, good night. Like, let's wrap this up.
Oh, so dissatisfying.
So dissatifying.
That feeling of like wanting to have the convo, and then it's like, oh, this is just an awkward, like small talk about big things is the hardest.
With a person who you haven't had small talk with for 35 years, and you're just like, right. what is happening? So yeah, there was a lot of that. And I think everybody was worried about me because I was pretty fucked up. So I was also having to put on a face of being better than I was for my parents because I didn't want them to worry about another child and all of that stuff.
When you say you were fucked up, what do you mean by that?
Depressed and like not fully suicidal, but close. And, you know, just having the darkest thoughts. And I think I had sort of struggled with mental illness earlier in my life. And suddenly it was front row center in the form of my sister. And I held her hand through all of it, all the way to the end. And I just was, I could see the chasm and I was dipping my toe in it all the time. But I also saw how devastated everyone was and I didn't want my parents to be concerned and that's ultimately why I didn't do it. But it was like, they can't lose two kids to this, like back to back. That's just, it's not fair to anyone. So I had to sort of put on a better face than I was doing. Now they know how bad it was. But at the time, I was keeping a lot from them.
And were you and your sister, is that something the two of you bonded over, like that sense of depression?
You know, I think my older sister did too, to an extent. Like, I think if you're sort of sensitive and intelligent, you're just drawn to the dark shit. And so, you know, Sylvia Plath and Elliot Smith and all our favorite artists killed themselves. So we were the dark kids who loved this stuff. And it wasn't like a gothy fetishization, but we understood that line between, you know, tapping into the brilliance and the mental illness sort of taking over.
Got it. You wrote about it. Was that something, did that help?
That helped a ton, yeah. Because, you know, this is such sad stuff, but I am a funny dude. I do stand-up comedy, and it was going excellently for me, and then this happened, and I just kind of stopped doing comedy. I still had this impulse to get it all out. So I started writing all sorts of crap, and I wrote this just gushy 10,000-word thing I posted on my website about all of it. And then that was like the biggest catharsis I had felt. I hadn't gone to that therapy yet. And then that really helped. And then off of that piece and other podcast appearances and stuff, I got a agent who was like, write a book. And I started writing a book. And then that really, I didn't go writing a book because I had arrived at my thoughts yet. I arrived at my thoughts through writing the book.
Right.
So it was up there just like cry typing, and my wife would be like, are we okay up here? It's like, I think this means it's good. Like, more coffee. But yeah, so it helped immensely.
That the way you put that of like, I'm gonna butcher it now, but the idea of like, I didn't write a book because I understood what I was writing about, but I started to understand it as I was writing. That means I understand that idea of like, as I try and talk about it, I'm discovering it as it's coming out of my mouth. I'm like, oh, I guess I feel like this. And it really does help me as a coping mechanism to talk about it more, which I hope isn't just an excuse for me liking the sound of my own voice. But I do think it's a thing that helps me understand my own thoughts the more that I'm like, you know, verbal about it.
Dude, I couldn't agree more with that. And I think it's a fine line between self-helpy and cheesy when you're in this ballpark of putting stuff out into the world, but finding it as you do it is what keeps it being genuine and not my year of saying yes or eat, pray, love or something. It's like, you know what I mean? It's like, it makes it be in the memoirs and not the self-help aisle. And like, that is finding it while you do it versus like, I've got some thoughts. I'm a guru on grief. Here we go.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, otherwise you're kind of an asshole.
Right. Donate to my new kind of therapy that I came up with. Like, we all go to a hill.
Yeah. And inevitably, you know, now you got to sleep with everyone's wives and drink the Kool-Aid. It's just, it always goes cult fast.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to, but you have to.
God talks to you. God talks to you, and that's what God said.
That's just what's happening. Yeah, I mean, your experience of posting on the blog also, I, on the 10-year anniversary of my son dying, tweeted about it and like wrote a bunch of tweets on the subject. And similarly, I don't have like a big Twitter following. You know, I'm not famous or anything, but it became like it's the thing that got me thinking about everybody else who is sad all the time.
Yeah.
Like I sort of assumed for a long time that I was now we're getting into my shtick. I've sort of assumed that this was like kind of my thing. Like me and my wife, we had a kid who died and like, just sorry, but nobody else is going to understand this. This is like not a thing that has ever happened to anybody else. Whatever happened to you sucks, but it's not like this. And starting to, like, the responses that I got to posting about it on social media, which is normally a cesspool,
right?
Like, really, really changed my point of view on the world. Just, like, hundreds of people telling these, like, horrible stories, a lot of them about children or whatever.
Yeah.
It made me think that there was more that I could contribute here without making myself too self-important. I mean, give myself a certain amount of self-importance, an appropriate level.
One must.
One simply must.
I have a question for you, though. I mean, when you get those reactions, because I wrote the book and people will come up and I did a book tour and people will share the most gut-wrenching stuff with you. And it does make you feel less alone. and your empathy is awakened, but is it ever overwhelming for you? Or you're like,
oh, yeah.
Oh man, like I'm so sorry for you, but I'm pretty full up with grief. Like I can't take yours on right now as well. It's a hard line.
It is. Yes, I would say that it is overwhelming. I would say I feel overwhelmed if when someone tells me their story, I feel like I put myself in the position to fix them. You know what I mean?
Right,
which I
right.
wouldn't want somebody to do to me. But I get like listeners of this podcast send emails that I truly like. I love them and I feel honored and privileged to get them telling me like the stories of things that have happened in their lives or how they felt like, you know, like they didn't deserve feelings of grief or whatever. And as long as I remember, like the response to this email is not going to be the thing that makes them feel happy every single day for the rest of their lives,
right?
Then I can feel okay. But I have to like calibrate myself because I don't know what part of me, just the way that I was programmed was, someone is sad, now you make them happy. And that's part of like my comedy upbringing too. It's like, the whole world is garbage. Let me come in here and take it on my shoulders to make you forget about that. When someone tells me some sad thing in their life, and usually something profoundly sad, I am like, my instinct that I have to jump past is, okay, you have to send them back the email that makes them happy for the rest of their lives.
No presh.
And that feels overwhelming to get a story that's, well, you know, I'm sure you've heard them, like just tons of horrible stories, and be like, well, now I don't worry, I have the exact pithy statement that will fix this. And so I do have to stop.
What's funny though, I love that. But it's, I understand that impulse as well. Like, and the further I get away from that death and all the other sad things that keep happening, I do come back to this sort of absurdity of like, yeah, we got this much time left. You want to cry, you want to laugh. Like we'll be reunited with this person in no time, or we won't, and we'll be in the dirt ground together, not sentient, feeling pain. I'm going to laugh at the insanity of this world for as long as I can and hopefully see the beauty of it. And that's like what keeps me going every day, because I do feel like it's still a gift. So just like soak it up, eat all the food,
eat all,
and like bow out.
Yeah, exactly. Kill the buffet. That's what you're here for. They said it's all you can eat.
Listen, I'm not saying you shouldn't jog too. That's a nice thing afterwards, but definitely don't hold back.
Yeah, I'm not saying you shouldn't jog. That's great. Well, we can get that, can go on merch. That's almost catchy enough.
It's funny you thought of that. I'd like to show you these slap bracelets.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
You were talking about being reunited. Do you think about that? Is that something you do think about? I mean, I'm not saying that you're like, you know, Christian, although you may be, it doesn't seem like you are, but if you...
I'm not.
But do you have some idea of like seeing her again?
I'm always careful to say agnostic, not atheist, because, mm-hmm. you know, anyone who's sort of... I resent anyone who's certain about it.
Oh, I hate certainty, just in general, not even about that, but just like people who are so sure of stuff. I mean, I'm also envious of it. I'm also like, God, I wish I was like that. I wish I knew anything.
I know.
But everything, I'm like, how can you be sure that that is the right thing? All of it.
Especially the eternal questions that have plagued mankind for all of existence. And you're like, I got it. Went to church twice, like F off. You don't know. So anyway, I'm agnostic, but I there's a level of spirituality I allow myself, and like, not to out my Colorado, but a lot of it is in nature And I've had a lot of odd, just strange experiences where I felt Lydia, especially early on. And so I definitely am open to that. And, you know, like sometimes she'll appear in dreams. And those are like gifts now. And I assign more meaning to them than my brain just throwing out a file at that time. I think they're visits somewhat. And so I hold open the hope that there's more of those later on.
Like you have experiences with her, like in nature, what do you mean by that? What's an example of something like that?
I mean, I wrote about this in the book and it was insane, but like I kept having, and I've you probably have encountered this. A lot of people who have suffered trauma like this, I don't know if they're looking for it harder. So maybe they're seeing something that's not there and assigning meaning that isn't, or there's meaning there. But I kept having very strange run-ins with this red-tailed hawks. Like insane experiences where one landed on my car and like, what is happening? A hawk landed on my car? Like, and then a couple days later, there was one, I was doing some work with friends and it kind of like came up to the window of the place we were at and just looked at us all. And I was like, that's strange. I'm going to go investigate this. And my friends were like, whatever you need, dude, we get it, grief boy. And I went out and had a really like close encounter with this red-tailed hawk, and I thought that was strange. And then my mother, without me telling her that, was like, check this out, and shared two experiences that were just eerily similar. And both of us in that moment felt like, Lydia, like, is that, you know, and I even said it to this one hawk, and it just kind of looked at me and flew off. And when my mom shared that, I was like, well, now something's going on. And then they went away, but you know, and red-tailed hawks are ubiquitous. They're everywhere, but never like this close. And so we assigned meaning there. And now I'll have experiences sometimes like that, that I'm like, eh, I felt her there.
And you describe it as assigning meaning as opposed to like, I don't know, that seems like a very deliberate choice, the word assign, as opposed to like the meaning being there.
Yeah.
It's like, I have decided this means this thing to me. Is that deliberate to you? Is it like, I know that this might not be here, but I'm putting it there and fuck everybody. That's what it is to me.
It might be deliberate because I'm such a cynical asshole. So like, I know how that sounds.
Yeah, I mean, I'm skeptical too. So I that's what I'm trying to draw out, that idea, yeah.
I think it is that I put up a language barrier of like, I get that this is ridiculous versus me just going in and being like, look at these crystals I have. Like, I have to sort of self-police because I don't want to come off as too hippy-dippy. But I certainly... if someone's willing to go there with me and I have the time and they're like, oh, you're cool. I'm not assuming that you're, you know, this like spinning off the face of the planet spiritualist. then I'll be like, I feel the meaning of this 1000%. Like there's no doubt in my mind that was my sister stopping in to say hello. And like, I don't even know what part of her journey she was on at that time. And I hope she's now further cemented in the next realm that she doesn't have to come back and visit me and stuff like that. But they were like breadcrumbs at my lowest, being like, you can do it, you can do it, you can do it, you know?
No, I don't know what you mean by that. Breadcrumbs meaning like that those experiences helped you feel better?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's another just experience where when all this was going on, and it's all a big jumble of time, those 3 years after that are a blur. I made a TV show. None of it can I delineate clearly. But a very dear friend, I wrote for a newspaper. He wrote for the newspaper as well. So cynical, ink-stained, alcoholic journalist types. His wife who's a dear friend now, is, you know, a self-described empath and feels things and is more in touch with the other side. And I remember in this era, I didn't know this boy, his wife, that well. I knew him. We were at a party and she came up to me and just was like, I have to talk to you. And I was like, all right. And she's like, your sister's trying to get through to you like so hard. And at the time I was like, whoa, you're crossing a line. Like this is insane. And she's like, I'm sorry. And it all came out. And she's like, feel my pulse. And I felt her pulse. And it was like, you need to go to the hospital. It was insane what was going on. And she kind of spilled out, like, she's trying to talk to you. She hears you, blah, blah, blah. And I was literally like, get away from me. I don't want to do this here. And a couple days later, in the next day, in fact, my friend's like, listen, I get the skepticism. Here's the way she's been right about stuff in our life. Here's the five things where I was like, my God, my wife's got this weird gift. And then she and I spoke for 3 hours on the phone a couple days later. And she just, it was really this profound moment that sort of pulled in the hawk sightings and pulled in a lot of what I was feeling. And she just like spoke to me in that moment. And it was random as hell, but it was profound. And it felt like Lydia was trying to get to me through her. And that really opened me up to a lot of like Lydia telling me to not kill myself because of her.
And is that the message that came through to you? Would you have thought of that prior to speaking with this empath? Like, was there something that some sense of clarity in the communication you felt like you were having with the red-tailed hawks?
No, there was no sense of clarity other than just like, I just got bowled over emotionally by this experience and I felt my sister, but there was no clarity as to what any of this meant. And, you know, this woman sort of told me after this tearful conversation where I'm like, okay, great. You've convinced me. Lydia's trying to get to me through you. What does she want to say? You know? And like, she's just like, basically she said, you can let go of me. And that I'm here, like, and I'll sort of show you signs every now and again that I'm here. And like, don't like, just cause I'm dead doesn't mean I'm gone type of thing. And so then I selfishly started looking for those all the time. And now 10 years later with my insane homeschooled approach to what the philosophy of life is and what the religion and all that, I hope Lydia doesn't have to hang around me as much. I hope she can be free and not have to worry about her brother.
Got you. You're like the idea being that there's like better afterlife shit than like hanging out with you and being like, hang on, I gotta go. I know you guys are getting ready to chill, but I gotta just go talk to my brother for a second. I gotta be a hawk for like 15 minutes. I'm gonna come right back.
Exactly. Like keep me safe, keep my kids safe, but go have more fun than this. Like, you don't, I'll see you on the other side. I'm all right.
Yeah.
You got me through the worst of it.
I mean, this is not my place to say, I don't feel like I'm going to cry saying this, but I bet if it works the way that you think it does, it's probably fucking cool for your sister to come back every once in a while.
Sure.
I would think it would be like, hey, you know what, guys? I'm going to do the hawk thing for 10 minutes because I miss my brother. I don't know why this is making me emotional.
No, man, I love that. I hope so. Yeah, you know, it's a lot. There's like guilt and anger and, you know, you would think that someone listening to this would be like, well, you have a lot to be mad at her about her having to come around every once in a while and hawk form to cheer you up seems like a small price to pay. However, I have come to such a understanding, which I didn't have before, of like, and this is the cliche and this is a talking point, mental illness as a disease, like cancer, and as not the fault of the person who has the mental illness. I've said it enough times, I believe it now and I preach it now. So I don't, yeah. I'm not angry at her anymore. And I'm like sad as hell about it, like you would be about someone who died of cancer or any tragedy, but I'm so not pissed about it or think she copped out or any of that crap. I don't view suicide that way for anyone. So I just feel like mental illness took over this person and won, and what a sad battle.
Right. Like over, I mean, you described it, the analog to use was cancer, right? It's just like being overcome by it effectively.
Absolutely. And it's not as clear cut because they can't just say there's a tumor here. They can't, you know, so it's confusing as hell as they go through it. And sometimes the person is depressed and down, and sometimes the person's themselves, and it can be over the course of a day. And so you're like, oh, they're fine. They're just being a flake, or they're just being too depressed, like sack up. And so then only in hindsight are you like, oh no, I think for the last 2 years, this cancer was growing and growing and growing and taking over more of her brain. And that's now how I straight up look at it.
Can you talk a little bit about the anger that you felt when it happened originally? Because I'm sure people who listen to this have, like, that's an experience that they have had if they have relatives who have died by suicide.
Sure. I think the anger was that is a lot of things. One, we were dead honest with each other. And, you know, there were numerous, there was a couple overdoses. There was a 72-hour hold in the psych ward. And we were all there. And I was there as much, if not more than anyone, and just being like, straight up, accident. You're saying it's an accident. You know, you're going all these drinks. You've got all these new pills. Real overdose or accident? And she's like, straight up accident. This is the wake-up call. I get it. I don't want, and I'm like, do you want to kill yourself? Do you want to die? Nope, I do not. And, you know, I believed it 100%. And so you feel very lied to in those moments. And we're a lucky family. My dad's a civil rights attorney and we have means. And so we were straight up, me and my sister were like, Lydia, if you're this fucked up, let's get you the best help in the world. Like, mom and dad will, do we need to send you to a place in Geneva? Like, we don't know. Do you need to move to a new country to escape all these problems here? Is it over? Like, every option's on the table. Not that we're billionaires, but it's like we have enough to help you get you the best help we can possibly get you. So if you're going to kill yourself, let's do that. Like, let's take some drastic moves. Do you need us not in your lives? Awesome. Go to, she studied abroad in Ecuador and we went and visited her and she was so happy. We were like, you want to go back to Quito and just rock out in South America for a while? Like, do it. And all of it, she's like, no, this is good. This is the help I need. And so that's just like, fuck, you're lying to our faces. Or was the disease lying to their face?
Yeah.
And then you also, it's so weird. I didn't resent any of it on myself. Like I got really traumatized by it all, but I was like, that's fine. I'm mad at you for what you did to mom and dad and like how the rest of their life has to look. That's shitty. And so that's when you have to tap into like, you didn't do this. The disease did that, but that still makes me sad. To think about how my parents have to have just in the same boat you're in, don't have their kid anymore. And that's just like, you get mad at her for doing that to them.
Sure.
Then you got to let that anger go and say like, this wasn't her fault, or you're just going to be angry yelling at a person who's not there your whole life.
Right. And does that point of view, the change of like being angry to understanding like, you know, maybe one, she doesn't deserve for me to be angry. And also that it's not practical for me to be angry. That comes from time plus therapy or what? Like, how do you get to the new point of view?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And I think there's no timetable for it either. I also just got tired of being mad at her. Cause like one thing I haven't mentioned on this podcast is how funny she was. Like, she was the funniest, weirdest sense of humor. And that's how we bonded, was like the oddest comedic riffs, just trying that, you know, it was like comedy jazz. Like, you played the off notes. And right. I loved doing that with her. And so our relationship was funny, forced. That's how I'd describe it. That's how we related, was like riffing all our lives. And so to suddenly be like mad at the person you laughed the hardest with the most felt new and like wrong in terms of how to remember her. So she died when she was 28, and I've assigned this arbitrary timetable of like, it seemed like the last 2 years is when it got crooked. So I was like, dude, you had 0 to 26 of like Riff City with your funny ass sister who you just howled in the basement being idiots with. And so you're hung up on these two where like she was going to every shrink possible. I think the 26 is more what you should try to focus on.
That's great. I mean, I think that resonates with me, that idea of like, you got something great. You know what I mean? And that might not resonate for everybody, because maybe for everybody, whatever their story is, what they got wasn't great.
Right.
But to be like, we had this time, something that I've learned from grief is that perspective of like gratitude for what it is that you have or that you had, as opposed to like the universe owes me this many years with my sister. And the universe is like, bro, I can't even hear you.
Totally.
I'm not paying attention to you.
And also it's like, the universe owes you nothing, and that you should now be more aware of the finite amount of time.
Yeah.
So like, to be grief-stricken and miserable for the rest of your time is sort of not honoring the good time you had with that person.
Yeah.
That person doesn't want you sad. That person and you just laughed your ass off. So like, you being sad, that person hates that. It makes them sad.
Right.
So you want to honor that person, like, keep laughing. Like, and don't be cheesy about it. Like, oh, there, it was a gift and there are only gifts and we must appreciate the gifts. No, you were fucked. You got screwed. It's unfair. But a lot of people get screwed. And I remember, like, this is like so dark, but I saw this movie during all this. It's called, what was it called? Beasts of No Nation. It's this horribly sad film. It's about Idris Elba plays like an African warlord, and it's about African children of war. And it's so well done. And I remember watching it, and it is the most effed up thing you've ever seen. Like, children killing, raping. It's just awful. And it happens. And I remember watching that and being like, I got it all right, man. Like, I got it. This ain't the worst thing going on the planet. This is my little story.
Yeah, for sure.
And for some reason, it was gallows humor and a dark-ass film, but I was like, dude, there's a lot of misery out there. There is a lot of terrible things happening, and terrible thing happened to you, but relatively speaking, man, you're still pretty well off, especially if you can get the help that you need.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's... That feels like an uncomfortable truth. My wife works in a pediatric intensive care unit now, and so she sees like kids in just awful shape, or like, you know,
yeah,
situations where like the kid is doing great and then suddenly it takes a turn or whatever. Like, kids living, and she's like, you know, what happened to us? Really, like, people have it way worse. And that is, I don't know if there's comfort in that, but there is like a sense of context, at least. It's like, that sense before I tweeted about it of like, nobody has ever even heard of a child dying. We made that up. That we invented that.
Right.
That sense of like, you are definitely wrong.
Right. And I have a line in my one man show. I was like, it's all very Russian. It's just like, what, you're just now learning that the life is shit? Like, what are you, new? Like, it's just kind of like, yeah, welcome to it, bud. And that's a sad, cynical new way to look at the world, but it's also like the armor we might need to walk through it.
Yeah, I think there's watch me butcher people's firmly held religious beliefs, but I think one of the tenets of Buddhism is that everything is suffering. Like, suffering is, like, all of it is suffering. And I think that's not even, oh God, I mean, the Buddhists are going to be so mad if that's a thing that Buddhists get, but the
you just lost your huge Buddhist audience.
That's 100 million Buddhists clicking onto another podcast.
You can hear phones in Nepal being put down.
Yeah, what is the sound of no one listening to your podcast? But I don't know. I remember taking like an intro to Buddhism class in college and being like, this is the stupidest thought anyone has ever had, and then revisiting that idea as an adult after suffering a tragedy and being like, oh, okay, I think I actually do understand what you were trying to say.
No, those lessons are like, you're right, they're so profoundly simple, but that's why they're profound. Like, you know, the hackneyed Buddhism thing I know kind of is like, it should be you want to achieve a state of unthinking. I know that that's a tenet of Buddhism, a state of like non-thinking. And when you read that before, you're like, okay, cool, don't think about anything, got it. But then you're just one... When you actually do that, when you're not thinking about anything, and this is cheesy and a bro of me, but I play indoor soccer like a washed up athlete, and it's the 1 hour a week I don't think about anything.
Yeah, sure.
I just like in the game, and I come home from that and I'm on cloud nine. My wife's like, this is so good for you, because I think that's what it is. It's like the state of non-thinking.
Yeah.
So if you can find that, be it like going on a hike or yoga or something, that's so healthy for your brain to just stop. obsessing.
I love that. I love that recommendation. I also like that the podcast is about grief, but it's also about absolutely ruining Buddhism. I mean,
yeah,
it's.
I think that should be the pod within the podcast, just like butchering Buddhism.
We're spinning it off.
Yeah,
yeah. Every week, two people try to remember one thing about Buddhism.
The cover art's like a monk on fire as he's so angry.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, back to more serious stuff. We talked a little about grief changing our perspectives on loss. Are there other ways in which you feel like grief has changed you as a person?
I think that's a good question. I guess if pressed, I'd say, because I wrote this book and I recently had a very dear friend die and I wrote an article about him, and that's like how I grieve is I write my thoughts out. I've started to realize I don't want to be the death guy, because I have friends that have gone through terrible things and like I'm their first call. And I'm always happy to be an ear for them. But I also just kind of want to be more of the joy guy.
Yeah.
And so I think I'm trying to tap into that and sort of, and it goes against my cynical nature and always being drawn growing up to dark movies, dark music, dark literature. Like that's what I liked. And I still do. But I'm trying to allow myself to be more innocently joyful of just, of things in the world that I appreciate. I guess the layman's term would be like more gratitudes, more grateful. And so I think that might be a byproduct of grief. And I don't know if it's because I wrote a book and it's like, I'm the grief guy, and now I want to run away from that.
Yeah.
Or it is not as cynical as that. It has nothing to do with my book. It's that I was sad for a long time, and now I want to be happy. And so I'm just like running towards things that make me happy versus questioning it.
Sure. I think we're in different places on that curve of like being grief boy. You know what I mean? I think like I'm entering the grief boy, my grief boy period for however long that will last. But I do understand a lot of people I've talked to who are comedians who have done some kind of public whatever it is about their grief have been like, hey man, just so you know, when you do this, the people who will be drawn to you and who will want to communicate with you, a lot of them will have some very heavy shit to lay on you.
Sure.
It's not like being, you know, whatever, a professional wrestler and the fans come up to you afterwards and you like give them a high five and they buy your merch and then they leave.
Right.
It's like somebody comes up to you and tells you the worst thing you've ever heard. And then the person behind them is like, I'm going to do that exact same thing.
And what an asshole you would be to be like, sorry, shop's closed.
Yeah.
Because you just poured your heart out, and it resonated with them because they've gone through a similarly terrible thing. You cannot say, I can't deal with it, sorry. Like, I guess you could. I can't. I certainly can't.
Yeah.
So those people that said that to you are right, but it is, you know, on some level you know that. And I think on some level you're finding your tribe.
Yeah, and I think with the part of that also that I have so much empathy, as I'm sure you do too, for those people, especially because I think part of the reason that they're drawn to me and to you and to whoever is that they know that bad shit has happened to us. So they feel comfortable talking to us about it. Whereas like they go to their church and nobody says, you know, we just had a miscarriage. Like you're just sitting next, they go play volleyball and they're just people playing volleyball. It never occurs to them. People aren't sharing their tragedies. So you feel like the only people who know about this are me and Adam, and that's it. No one else has ever experienced this because I've heard him. He's got a book about it. So it happened to him.
Right.
But it hasn't happened to anyone else.
Right.
And so I'm like, they have nobody. All they have is the people they see talking about it. And that's strangers a lot of the time.
Dude, exactly. And who knows through what means they found you and what their community is like in terms of this. Like we, you know, our mutual friend connected us for this podcast. And I think we travel probably in circles that are pretty empathetic and pretty therapy forward.
Yeah.
And pretty understanding of grief and accepting of it. You could be coming from a background where it's like, man up, pussy. And like, that's it.
Sure.
So like somehow they got your podcast or your book, my book, and like they've come to your show. My God, like you're blowing their mind. You're opening up them up to a world. So you can't be upset about it. And like, I think that's such a cool thing. A friend of mine who wrote a book is like, what's cool to me is that people will still find my book 8 years later and it'll speak to them as freshly as when I wrote it or whatever.
Yeah.
And so that's really cool. If you can be part of someone's grief journey, like it can be a lot because you just shared your heart and are exhausted, but also like you may have really, really helped someone. And that sounds cheesy, but like, hey, what else do we got is like shared experience.
Yeah, man. I would love to help someone, even if it's just me that I'm helping. But I mean, the thing that I get the most when you're talking about people who come from backgrounds that are like, you know, man up, dude, don't start trying to feel sad, is people being so mean to themselves about how they feel, about like, you know, I'm basically emails that I get, they're like, this bad thing happened and I'm a piece of shit. I want to be like, bro, it's you're fine. You're okay. This is normal.
Yeah, that it breaks my heart. I'm so grateful I live in a community that like was cool to watch me suffer and comic friends being like, dude, feel all the things you got to feel. The jokes will be here when you need to tell jokes. Like, don't even worry about it. And, you know, the comedy club owner in town reaching out and saying like, this stage is yours whenever you want it. Take your time. You know, you worry about, because I was on the come up when this all went down and I didn't want to like lose momentum, but I wasn't there. So I'm so grateful for the community I came from that supported me through that. But you got to be aware of people who don't have that.
Yeah.
And I also think it's so distinctly American, this fear of death. Like, not to, you know, I just went to Mexico and I happened to be there during Dia de los Muertos. And I've always wanted to see that. But man, roadside memorials everywhere with photographs of their dead. And on that day and several days afterward, they go to the funeral, or not the funeral, the cemetery. They sit at the gravestone with photos, with food, with booze, every family. And they like celebrate this person who's dead and gone. Or these people who are dead and gone. And it's every year they do that. And we have no holidays where it's like, now it's the dead day and we party with them. It's not sad. It's great.
Yeah. The closest that we come, I feel like, is Memorial Day. And really for us, it's like, that's when the mattresses are cheap and that's pretty much it.
And it's only for the military. You're not supposed to be like, well, my sister, they're like, nah, this is about the troops, dude.
No.
Like, so I you know, death is such a birth is a cause for celebration. We get birth announcements and death is like this sad parade of shame that you have to be like, I'm sorry to share that I'm sad about my dead beloved person in my life. I'm sorry to share it. You like whisper it, you know, any any funeral is hushed tones. And it's just like, I don't know. I think the American relationship to death is not a healthy one. It's a lot of fear.
I agree with that.
And it's 100% something everybody does. So
yeah.
I don't know. I was blown away by how Mexico did it and was just very into that idea.
Have you seen the movie Coco? Have you seen this movie?
I have seen the movie Coco.
Yeah. Oof, obliterated me. I mean, I couldn't even, I'd ask my kids what happened at the end. I was crying so hard. I was like, just tell me.
I saw it before I had kids and now they'd have to pull me off the floor of the theater, just popcorn stuck to my face.
All right, I want to ask you one more question before I let you go. Thank you for being here for all this time.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me.
We touched on this a little bit when you were talking about red-tailed hawks, but do you think of your sister as being someplace now? Is there a place that she exists for you or many places?
It's many places. I will go to that bench in the park and talk to her if I need to talk to her. And I feel guilt about that. I was talking about earlier, it's like she doesn't need to come around and help me out. But if there's something that's like really serious, like my mom recently we thought it was a stroke, but it wasn't. It was a thing that simulates the symptoms of strokes, and my mom's fine. But it was terrifying for 3 days and in the hospital and awful. And I went to that bench and I was like, I know you're closer to the other side than I am, Lydia. Like, anything you can do. So sometimes I will go when it's desperate and just be like, if you can, it's not on you, I get it, but if you can, if there's anything you can do, like, please tap in for a second. So I still do that.
Right on. Adam, thanks so much for doing this. This was another episode of A Good Cry, and I hope it helps. A Good Cry is produced by Radio Point and HeadGum with executive producers Alex Bach, Sabrina Fonfetter, Richard Corson, Daniel Powell, and Houston Snyder. Recorded, edited, and mixed by Bree Mattan.
That was a HeadGum podcast.